of equal opportunity, where a man born in a log cabin can grow up to be president, and the son of an immigrant can become a movie mogul. Through hard work, initiative, and intelligence, you should be able to move up the class structure. My guest is Paul Fussell, author of the new book, Class, A Guide Through the American Status System. He reports that there's not much mobility between classes. And what a lot of people don't realize is that status, or class, in America is dependent not only on how much money you have, but also on how you dress, what you hang on your wall in your living room, and what magazines you subscribe to and where you vacation. To help you figure out what class you're really in, Fussell concludes his book with a living room test, in which you get points for oriental rugs and ceiling fans, and lose points for reproductions of Picasso paintings and for having transparent plastic covers on your furniture. Fussell has divided America into 9 classes, plus an X class, which is bohemianism, which he describes as a way of living outside the class system. Paul Fussell is a professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania. He's written extensively on World War II. His books include The Great War and Modern Memory, Abroad, British Literary Traveling Between the Wars, and The Boy Scout Handbook and Other Observations. His new book, Class, is published by Summit Books. Paul Fussell, welcome back to Fred.
Thank you, Terry. Happy to be here always.
Why did you want to write a book about class?
Well, in part to pay my son's bills at Oxford University, which is where he's been for the last 2 years, but in part also because I've always been fascinated by this as a sort of forbidden subject in the United States. And subjects that are forbidden always attract me for some reason. And so I thought it'd be fun to really look at this subject and to be funny about it, but try to be sort of serious, too. And that's what I've tried to do.
You suggest that you can figure out what class somebody's in by how they react to discussions of class.
Yeah, to a degree. At the beginning of the book, I say if this whole subject annoys you terribly, you're probably middle class and rather insecure there. Because nobody who's secure in his class can be at all distressed by discussions of it. I mean, he welcomes publicity about it, whereas people who are what I call class frightened don't like the subject brought up. It's too embarrassing. I'd like to make it a subject that everybody talks about all the time, actually, like sex. You know, it's no more shameful than sex. Let's talk about it.
Reviewers who have written about your book have all taken... Well, there are some exceptions, but at least two of them have taken the living room test at the end and have found to their dismay that they register in the middle class category.
Yes.
And they're very disturbed to find that they're, according to your test, in the middle class. Is it true of most middle class people that they don't want to be identified as being middle class?
I think so, and I think increasingly, actually. I think almost everybody in the country who's middle class wants to be identified as a member of the upper middle class. This is why they love to subscribe to The New Yorker. This is why they love to take in luxury Christmas gift catalogs and so on. And this is why the words like luxury and gourmet solicit them constantly, because those words don't belong to the middle class. They belong to an imagined upper middle class that everybody wants to belong to. Somebody I quote in the book, I forget who it was, conducted a questionnaire of middle class people, and he said, what class would you like to belong to? And something like 60% said upper middle class. That's really the stylish class at the moment.
Why?
Why? Because everybody imagines that it's the class of successful people. It's the class of doctors. It's the class of lawyers, successful writers, high-paid professors, people that get to travel in Europe, people who have small boats for recreation, people who play tennis and golf and go skiing and so on, people who have a little extra cushion against the horrors of actuality, a big savings account, your upper middle class. If you don't have a savings account at all, you're middle class, probably.
I think some of the people who don't want to be identified as middle class would prefer to be identified as bohemian.
Yeah, yeah, and I deal with that in the book, too. I invent a category called Category X, which is people who are ashamed of being in the class they're in or they're born into, whichever class it may be, and who therefore try to find a way of being bohemian and loose and outside the class system.
You divide America into 9 classes. Mm-hmm. Can you run through them real quickly?
Yeah, well, let me say first that I could have done it in 3 classes, 5 classes, 36 classes. I thought 9 was both amusing because nobody's thought of it before and quite accurate. So at the very top, there's what I call the top out-of-sight class. You never see them because they're residences, usually in the countryside, or on Caribbean islands or Greek islands, which they own, are out of sight. You don't see their driveways. You don't see them in public, and that's at the very top. The very bottom is a corollary class, which I call the bottom out of sight. You never see them either because they're institutionalized, hospitalized, or they're in penitentiaries. They've been removed from society very much the way the top out of sight have removed themselves from society. All right, moving from the top down, the next class is the upper class, and that's the class, say, of the Kennedys or of the F.D. Roosevelts and of people like that. Below that is the great upper middle class, which is the preppy handbook class that consists of successful orthodontists, physicians, rich lawyers, successful stockbrokers, and their families. Below the upper middle is the middle class, which is very large and which most members of it are a little ashamed to be there. They want either to rise or to sink. Below that, we used to have a thing called the lower middle class, but I think that's been wiped out largely by the inflation of the 1960s and 70s. So I posit below the middle class three proletarian classes. There's high proles, as I call them rudely, high proles, middle proles, and low proles. And they are wage earners who don't have any savings and who don't have much future to look forward to, but they're perfectly respectable. We'd call them working people or working class people. Below that are what I call the destitute, and these are real welfare cases, and there are many more of them than most people want to recognize. And below that are the bottom out of sights, who are people who have finally leaked out, even out of the welfare class, and are now institutionalized. The most interesting places in this whole scheme, I think, are the top of the middle class, where people are dying to get into the upper middle class, the successful class, the people who wear three-piece suits without embarrassment. And the top of the pro class, where people want to get into the middle class and want to get a little more respectability than, say, a workman on wages has. There are nine classes, as I've projected them, but as I say, there could be almost any number, as long as you recognize some of these important divisions between classes.
What do you see as being the places for mobility? What do you see as being the places where there's mobility between classes?
There's not much mobility. There's imagined mobility between the middle class and the upper middle class, and there's imagined mobility between the pro class and the middle class. But I think it's largely fictional and fantasy, because there's not much possibility of entering these things. To get into the upper middle class, really, you have to have gone to the right university. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it. And to get into the middle class, you have to have correct grammar. And this is a big problem with the proles, because they usually don't. They use double negatives and that sort of thing, and they don't speak in coherent paragraphs. And they lack a kind of verbal polish that identifies the middle class. It's very hard to make those two transitions, but those are the two transitions you most often see people trying to make. And some of that is very touching. I mean, people spending their lives having the right curtain so they can get into a certain class, it's touching. Saving up enough money to buy a Buick or a Chrysler, you know, when they've driven a Chevrolet before. And when it, you know, they take it very seriously. And as my book suggests, I think it's largely comic. It's comic pathetic, but it's comic, essentially.
What do you think your class bias is in analyzing other
classes? Oh, my class bias is upper middle, because that's the class I was born into. But I have another pull in another direction, which is towards what I call category X or bohemian, because I want to chuck the whole thing. You know, very strong motive in me, and I've lived abroad a great deal in Greece and France and Germany and England, is to escape the whole scene, quite shamefully, I recognize, and just to take off, you know, to travel forever. And to dump the whole class business, and that's the urge on me that I feel constantly to turn into a category X person. I mean, to wear dirty blue jeans and not have a steady job and buy all my clothes from L.L. Bean and live in a cabin without a telephone and so on. That's category X if you can do it, if you can survive that way. Another strong pull is the pull of the class into which I was born in Pasadena, California, which is like Westchester. Or, you know, like Bryn Mawr, it's a costly suburb of a large city. And that's Pasadena, and that class is the upper middle class, by which you go to the right private colleges and you wear the right clothes. And from the age of 8, I've learned how to wear jackets. I mean, that's a big sign of the upper middle class. If you feel most comfortable in a jacket, with or without a necktie, you're probably upper middle class, or you came from that class. That's a very good way to tell, actually, about whether you... what class you feel most comfortable in. If you feel most comfortable in a thing like a golf jacket that comes down the waist, you know, and has a zipper up the front, that's middle class. Jacket is upper middle. And so I feel shamefully upper middle class sometimes. And I feel sort of embarrassed about writing this book from a point of view that can be disclosed to be upper middle class. But that's the way it is. I can't change myself. And one reason I'm so fascinated in other people's class signals, the signals they send off in bars and restaurants and on the streets, is just that I learned how to be class sensitive by being a member of the upper middle class.
Do you think that being a member of the upper middle class makes you define certain things as being crass?
Crass?
That other people wouldn't define that way without your class bias?
I'm not sure. I don't really know. Yeah, I think my attitude towards class is a little mechanical and cut and dried. I'd grant that. And it might strike other people as cruel. It has struck some reviewers. One used the word mean. One used the word cruel. I don't think it's that way. I think it's scientific. I'd say it's scientific and open-eyed. I mean, the other books I've written have depended very largely on my noticing very closely things other people haven't noticed. And I think it's true of this book, too. I like to notice very small differences between people. With women, Peter Pan collars and straight collars. And with men, polyester shirts and non-polyester shirts. There's lots to be said on the side of both. But they're different. Their implications are different. The implication about the life you live and the way you want to represent yourself are different, and we should recognize them. I think nobody presents himself or herself in public without, if they're at all bright, without a consciousness that everything they do gives off category identifications. We don't want to call them class necessarily, but I am this type of person, you're always saying. That's why you wear blue jeans or cores or gray flannel trousers, and that's why if you're a woman, you wear a backpack or something else. You're making a statement about yourself to an audience. And I think we're not yet skilled enough in interpreting these statements. They're always there. And it's a nice sentimental, you know, affectation to pretend that we don't notice them. But we do notice them secretly, I think. And we notice this girl looks like a hippie. This girl looks like, Carolyn Kennedy. This girl looks as if she came from a lot of money and went to Bryn Mawr or Smith College. We don't usually voice these things. We sense them, and they're important to us in the way we understand people.
I guess it's Paul Fussell, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Class. Let's, if we may, look at what you're wearing and see what the signals are. It's a wool checkered sport jacket with a red paisley tie, a blue solid-colored shirt with a kind of coarse weave to it, like a coarse cotton.
Yeah, it's a coarse weave Oxford cloth shirt.
With green corduroy pants.
Tan, actually, yeah.
Okay, what are the signals that...
Okay.
And did you decide consciously, knowing that you were going
to
do this interview about class?
Absolutely, and I lay so much emphasis upon clothing and the signals that clothing gives off in my book that I dress very carefully for this, absolutely. I'm also wearing topsider shoes, which on me make me look like an elderly preppy, but still I wear them because I'm used to them. They're very comfortable. Now, the shoes sort of give off the signal, I am born into money, because the soles of these shoes, as you know, are white rubber, and they're all sort of serrated on the bottom as if they were meant to be used on the wet decks of a very costly yacht. And that's why topsiders are popular among the upper middle class or among people who want to give off the signals of upper middle class. I wear the corduroy trousers instead of gray flannels, which I ought to be wearing, partly as a gesture that I really want to be in Category X. That is, I'm dressing comfortable. I'm wearing sort of outdoor, very unpretentious, un-city clothes. Also, I'm trying to come out as an author, and that's very important. I want to indicate that I can dress any way I want because my livelihood as a writer doesn't depend on how I look. It depends on my language, which is not dressed in corduroy pants. The shirt is ostentatiously without acrylics. I mean, it's pure cotton. And that is supposed to be a sign of unredeemable upper middle class purity. The necktie is notable because it doesn't make any semiotic gesture at all. It has no language on it saying, thank God it's Friday, or it's nice to be a grandfather, or Countess Mara, or anything. It's just a series of little tiny foulard blobs, blue against a sort of burgundy background. It's understated, but it's still rich. The jacket is designed to indicate that despite the corduroy trousers over which I'm wearing it, I'm a person of consequence and solidity because the jacket is identifiable as a very costly Scottish tweed. And wearing it on corduroys is a way of sort of throwing it away. And that's my ensemble today. I should add that I can come on in numerous costumes like this, very many of them very different, depending on the class emanation that I want to put out at any moment. I can come on as elderly cowboy. I was once described when I was wearing my blue jean costume as a looking like a retired rodeo star who's gone into the money markets. That's another look. One thing I'd like my book to do is to sort of embolden people to play various class roles, which is fun to do and which you can do once you're secure within the signals.
Do you think that's really true? Look at John Malloy, for instance, who's been teaching his readers how to pose as if they were members of the upper middle class.
Yeah.
In the blue-skirted suits or pinstripe three-piece suits for men with the gold embossed pens. And
yes.
He's got the whole thing down.
Yeah.
I don't know if people actually fall for it or not, because there's a lot more beneath the surface.
They may, but I'm never really deceived by one of these people. They may deceive other people, but I think of myself as a fairly acute class sign reader. I meet a lot of his students and pupils on airplanes, and they don't know that I'm identifying them as Malloy pupils, but I am. And somehow the body isn't right. The clothes are right. I mean, they've got on the three-piece dark blue suit with a very thin pinstripe, the right shirt, which is usually rather careless, buttoned down, and a spreading out collar that spreads out between the top and the button. And they've got the right wristwatch, and they've got the right everything, but their bodies aren't right somehow. They're too big in the shoulders. They look like working-class people dressed up. Sometimes they look, you'll forgive me, almost like monkeys, you know, dressed up in a costume, in a way. They don't wear the clothes naturally. And they clearly care too much about the effect they're creating, which is not secure. They're supposed to be absolutely secure members of the upper middle class. If you give off the impression at all that you care what the audience thinks about you, that you're not taking it for granted that you're a great success in your presentation, you lose class, I would say.
What do you think is the absurd thing that's happening there? The way the person looks in a suit that they weren't really, quote, born into? Or the fact that our rules are so rigid that people are expected to do that in order to get anywhere?
Both things. I think about equally, yeah. A lot of these people, it's impossible to talk about this without giving off, the impression of snobbery, and I don't want to do that. A lot of the people who are trying to be middle class don't recognize that there's a middle class, upper middle class body. It's not physically developed. You don't have big muscles. You don't have big shoulders. And that's why natural shoulder is such a big thing among the upper middle class. You decline to come on as a physical man. You come on as a person, which, isn't all that masculine necessarily. Well, the trouble comes when you get people from lower middle class backgrounds who naturally come from a genetic tradition of good physical development. And you put them into suits, and their shoulders are too big. Their bodies are too athletic to be worn in a suit. A gentleman is not supposed to be an athlete, you see. He's supposed to sit in a boardroom or in a college president's office. He's supposed to live a sedentary life, and some of these people don't have sedentary bodies. On the other hand, to come to the second part of your question, I think it's absolutely ridiculous for people to imagine that you can, achieve a happy life by wearing a certain costume. Or not. And that's really what Malloy is saying. He's saying that success is the result not of talent, not of distinction, not of eloquence, not of intelligence, but of dress. And that's outrageous, of course.
But what are you saying by saying that someone who's a pro, as you put it, dressing in an upper middle class suit looks kind of like a monkey?
He does, yes. And
what's the message there that you're giving?
Well, I'm sorry for him that he has put himself in a position where to succeed, he's got to wear the right suit. I'd like to see him come on as a very distinguished pro, looking like, say, Lord George, or there have been numerous examples of people who were not born gentlemen who refused to pretend they were. Jimmy Carter's maybe one. I have great respect for somebody who can conduct, very subtle, shrewd, intelligent business in blue jeans or in whatever he likes to wear, an old flannel shirt or that sort of thing, like Robert Frost. And that's sort of the model. So I'm really very sympathetic with, shall we say, ordinary people or people who present themselves in an ordinary style. And I'm sorry that they imagine they have to costume themselves in order to do the work they're gifted at. The costuming doesn't seem to be a part of what really gets done. Goods being produced, bright ideas being entertained, and so on. It has nothing to do with dress. The whole subject deserves an infinitely deeper inquiry than I've been able to do.
Then why are you so careful about dress with your own clothes and so enjoy wearing different costumes, the middle-aged cowboy and the...
Well, I suppose it's because I'm imperfect. I'm imperfect. I love, you know, I love the role-playing element of life. I love acting and so on. And, you know, that's what I do. And one part of my life, I'm a very earnest university professor. Another part, I'm a very serious writer about the First World War, you know, moving readers to tears. Another part, I'm a buffoon, you know, in a book like this, or I'm a superficial social commentator. I don't see any inconsistency necessarily between these roles, and I like working in and out of them. It keeps me from being bored.
You think upper middle class people have more mobility in the role playing that they can do and get away with?
I don't think so. No, I think, alas, they're pretty well fixed in that class. I think the only people with real role-playing mobility are people in Category X who can more or less come on as any character they want to and who know all the styles.
Paul Fussell is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Class. Tell me what you think of this theory. And this was written by someone named Simon Frith, who wrote a book about rock and roll and the economics of rock music and the culture of it. And he said that he thinks bohemianism is a kind of meeting point between the lower class and the middle class. It's a way for middle class people to get out of it and a way for lower class people to get out of the lower class and maybe go from bohemianism into the middle class. And that in bohemianism, the two meet. What do you think of that?
Well, I'd agree. I think that's the center of bohemianism, or what I call Category X. But I think that definition is a little restricted. I'd also say that bohemianism is a great repository for aliens from all the classes. I mean, you get upper-class people who end there. Or very talented people, or eccentric people, curious people, people who don't really believe what society presents itself as, who end there, who don't come from the middle class or from the pro class. Who just come? I agree that that's where the class is located, but it has entrance from all the classes. It's a very rich place, I think.
Let me ask you to describe what you mean by the statement. The middle class buys for its morale. The upper class buys for laughs. Proles buy to pay their respects to technology and art.
Yeah. I was talking there specifically about the mail order catalogs that are aimed, obviously, at different social classes. And I meant that the upper class, since it has everything or can have everything, buys for laughs. I mean, it buys bright ideas, which it doesn't expect to last. It buys funny things to give friends that are halfway between insults and real gifts. It expects the presents it gives to be thrown away or given to the servants. It doesn't take them seriously. The middle class buys largely for its morale, to persuade itself that it's solid, that it's starting a generation that's going to go on for, you know, a dynasty. That it's a serious social class. So it buys things that are a little above itself. It will buy things that it thinks are art objects to put in the house and so on. The what was the third one? The pro class. What
did I say about them? Buys to pay their respects to technology and
art. Yeah, yeah. Somehow, I don't know, people that love elaborately trick watches and so on that show the time of day in Singapore. And show how many days have elapsed in the year so far. These tend to be proles. Proles somehow worship technology. They take it seriously. I think if you examine the social class of everybody who is terribly interested in the current space vehicle, what's it called? You know, that thing that's shot up with rockets and...
The space shuttle?
Yeah, the space shuttle. I think you'd find that most of them are proles. Because the rest of us have sort of lost interest in that. I mean, proles are always hopeful. They think really the cure for cancer is going to be found in space if we stay up there long enough. They really believe, they believe the whole technological pretense of the 20th century. It's partly because their education is so limited. So they tend to buy elaborate stereo sets, trick refrigerators, bad automobiles with control panels resembling those on space vehicles. They really fall for technological stuff, fancy radios and things, whereas the upper orders don't care about that, and the middle classes somehow invest much more in culture. Middle classes is where you get your big investment in culture. Picasso reproductions, Tutankhamun show souvenirs and things like that.
Do you think that advertisers subscribe to the same code that you do and use that code in trying to reach their target audience?
I think so very much, and I think that's one of the... It's not a well-kept secret because it's fairly obvious to anybody who looks and thinks, but it's certainly an interesting topic. One of the interesting things I think I have in the book is that The roller derby, you remember, used to be on television weekly, and it was there until advertisers discovered that the people who watched it were so poverty-stricken that they couldn't buy anything, so it wasn't worth an advertiser's time to put commercials on the roller derby. If you look at television a lot, as I tend to do, because it's a great way to learn about people, you discover that there's certain distinct class kinds of advertising that go with various shows or various class grades from the very top, like Mobil Oil supporting Brideshead Revisited, down to the very bottom. You know, see who advertises it to fake wrestling programs. You can get a sense of the way people's class identity is exploited by advertising. There's nothing wrong with it. I think, you know, it's quite obvious and one of the essentials of advertising. For example, a lot of advertising aimed at the middle class is aimed at that middle class sense of slight insecurity and anxiety. You know, do my armpits smell? Do I look all right? Has my suit been sufficiently dry cleaned? Could I eat off my kitchen floor if necessary? Is it that clean? Are my guests laughing at the dirt on my towels? And so on. It's an immense amount of anxiety advertising. Now, most anxiety advertising, including the advertising aimed at men, do I have enough insurance to take care of my poverty-stricken wife and children if I die? Or, as the middle class puts it, pass on. Anxiety advertising is very largely aimed at the middle class. You can almost identify the middle class by its liability to that kind of anxiety advertising. Now, to address the pro class of that advertising wouldn't get you very far because they don't care much about those things. The upper class knows that the whole thing is a con anyhow. Most of them own the companies that put out the advertising. So it's the middle class which becomes the sort of victims of anxiety address in advertising.
Well, I guess this is the appropriate time to turn to your quiz where you compare your living room to the list here, and you get points or subtract points for everything in your living room that's on this list, and then you tally them up and figure out if you're in the upper class, middle class, or pro. So let's go through some of these and see what they signify.
Okay.
Okay. Parquet floors. You get 8 points for a parquet floor.
Parquet floors are very classy, partly because they're archaic. I mean, you don't see them being put in now because they're very expensive and they take a lot of hand labor. So if you have a parquet floor in your house or apartment, it indicates that the place is 50 or 60 years old, and that's classy.
Okay, for a new oriental rug or carpet, you lose points.
Yeah.
No, yeah, for a worn one, you add 5, and for a threadbare one, you get 8.
That's right. A new one suggests that you're middle class and that you haven't received any oriental rugs by inheritance. You've gone out and bought one. The fact that you've bought an oriental rug is bad for you class-wise because that suggests that you are ambitious to be mistaken for an heir. If you have a threadbare one, on the other hand, which nobody would buy, the assumption is quite clear that you have received it by inheritance. That is, that you come from a long line of money and therefore presumably independence, freedom, and taste. And that's why there's a big difference between a new and an old oriental rug. I may say, just to clear myself of accusations of snobbery, that I have both new and old ones. I've bought new ones myself because I like them and I know that they bring me into class discredit, but I have them anyhow. I also have some old ones that I've inherited.
Hey, you don't have to apologize to us.
Okay.
Okay, any work of art depicting cowboys, you lose 3 points. Any, quote, professional oil portrait of any member of the household, you also lose 3 points for that.
Yeah, both those are very bad, partly because Frederick Remington is a very bad painter. And everybody should know that, and they should know the difference between him and Rembrandt. And if they don't know that, they should go out and learn it. The second one is that a general principle of high-class usage is that you very seldom call attention to yourself. In other words, the ambition of an upper-class person is to have his name never appear in public. And by exhibiting portraits of yourself in your own living room, you are sort of saying, I find myself a wonderful person, which is not in accord with the upper class tradition of understatement.
You lose a point for subscribing to either Smithsonian Magazine or the Scientific American.
Yeah, those are too earnest. They're not frivolous enough. They're perfectly sound. You don't lose 5 points, but you lose a little bit because they're kind of wholesome.
For the New York Review of Books, you'd get 5 points, but if you get the Hudson Review, you get 8.
Yes, that's a very important distinction. The New York Review is now becoming quite commonplace, like backgammon as a class signal, And a lot of middle-class people have discovered that they can elevate their class by simply subscribing to it. Whereas it takes a lot of curiosity and awareness to know about the Hunsdon Review. It circulates only about 8,000 copies. So I just put that in really as a jest.
Okay, for overflow books stacked on floors, chairs, etc., you get 6 points.
Yeah. Well, that's very good because it shows, or at least it argues, a sort of impulsive curiosity that's not planned. I mean, you're obviously not buying books in order to exhibit them to an audience of admiring observers with the books all lined up neatly in a bookcase and so on. It's a sign of sort of intellectual impulse, which is classy, I think, an impulsive curiosity.
You lose points for Eames chairs, but Eames is in quotes. What's the problem there?
Well, because there are a lot of imitation Eames chairs. That's why I put it in quotes. And you lose points for it because it was stylish about 20 years ago, and it's now a declassed fad. Any fad like the hula hoop, which was stylish 15 years ago, which is still persisted in, is very class-lowering.
How funny do you mean this to be, and how serious?
I mean it to be quite funny, but I also mean that there's a serious point woven into the center of it, and the serious point is, I suppose, that there is such a thing as taste, I believe. There's such a thing as understatement. There's such a thing as a difference between really good stuff and kitsch, and that's what the book is, in a sense, about. I think it's funny to lay too much emphasis on it, and that's what the book does, ironically. The book pretends to be a sort of social scientific survey of this, as if one could be accurate in these things instead of just sort of sensing them. And also the book has fun by pretending that the speaker is a sort of haughty aristocrat when actually he's a person just like everybody else.
You've done a lot of traveling in Europe. Mm-hmm. How does the class structure of European countries compare to the class structure in America?
I think it's simpler, actually. It's much easier to divide most European countries, by which I mean, say, Italy, France, Germany, and maybe Belgium and England and Holland, into three classes, working, middle, and upper, although the upper gets smaller all the time. It's much harder in America. Partly we're a bigger country. We have many more sort of ethnic feeds into this country, traditional cultural feeds. Everybody's an immense amalgam of various traditions. They pretend to be Jewish or British or Italian or whatever, but actually we're much more complicated than that. And describing an American as, say, Henry James was aware 50 or 60 or 70 years ago is about the most difficult thing in the world. That's why any book about class in America has to be, to a degree, a send-up of the whole idea of ascertaining class.
For anyone who takes the signs literally of, like, what kind of wallpapers in the house or something, it's very strange for anyone who rents a house, because you rent a house complete with the wallpaper and the rugs that are there.
Yeah.
How would you categorize that?
You mean their problem?
Well, the fact that renters end up with things that don't really describe their taste.
Yes, but everybody knows that. You know,
right.
Who comes into their house, they know what comes with the apartment and what they themselves, the renters, have brought into it. I don't see any problem there. I live in an apartment, and I don't care anything at all about the walls or the window frames or anything, because I can't do anything about it, and everybody who sees them knows I can't. So I carefully indicate my taste and my style by certain appliques and objects that I put around to cue people in about what the style is likely to be. We all do this, and I think it's better to know we do it than to be ignorant that we do it. I think everybody in every class, especially in the living room or in the front yard, carefully positions objects or is careful not to position objects that will present themselves in the way they want to be understood by the world. And nobody wants to write himself down. Everybody wants to present himself at his or her best. And that's why these objects are so important.
You do describe a phenomenon that you call class sinking for
people
who are interested in moving downward in mobility.
Yes. This was very common in the 1960s and very common with young people, especially, who resented the fact that they came, for example, from the upper middle class, and therefore they began to cut off their blue jeans and to take up the study of the guitar and of Eastern religions and so on, partly to give offense, but partly with an instinct that the whole class system they were born into was not the one that they belonged in. So they were trying to sink in class. And some have sunk so far out they've gone completely out of sight in various communes and ashrams and so forth. Whether you will say good riddance or not, I suppose, depends on your character.
How self-conscious has writing this book made you? Since you've tried to codify everything, everybody knows you've done it, and they're going to be seeing where your stuff fits into the code that you've created.
Well, I'm very conscious that I'm going to be very closely watched. But also, I don't know, I think it's kind of funny. To be honest, I've been this conscious about class for many years, maybe 20 years, and I've always regarded myself as being fairly closely watched, partly because I'm a professor, and I'm usually on set. I mean, I'm in front of a classroom, and kids are looking at me saying, what do you think of his necktie today? What point is he making by wearing those shoes, and so on? But I expect to be very closely observed, yes. I was hoping, when the book was published, to leave the country, actually, for about six months and just hide out for a while, and then to come back almost incognito. But I found that impossible to do.
One last question. You're teaching now at the University of Pennsylvania, formerly at Rutgers. Is that a change in status at all?
It's a little change, yeah. And I'll say quite frankly that I expect the students there to be about the same as my students at Rutgers. But I've been around Penn a bit, and I can pronounce that the students there are better dressed.
And
perhaps better looking, but they're certainly better dressed.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Paul Fussell has been my guest, and his new book is called Class, and it's just been published by Summit Books. It's called Class, A Guide Through the American Status System, and Paul Fussell spells his last name F-U-S-S-E-L-L. And he's the author of several other books, including a Boy Scout Handbook and The Great War and Modern Memory, and also Abroad, British Literary Traveling Between the Wars, and he's now teaching at the University of Pennsylvania. It's 20 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I want to remind you that at 4 o'clock today, we continue the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series. Our guest today will be pianist Albert Daly. Every Monday afternoon at this time, 91FM's arts reporter Julie Burstein joins us. Julie, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. This week, Report on the Arts will focus on two plays currently on stage in Philadelphia. There's quite a listing of plays here, I think more than most months. And the plays that I'll focus on are both ensemble efforts with very different focuses. The first is A Flea in Her Ear, which has opened at the Walnut Streets Theater first season. And actually, first we'll talk about Marat Saad, which has been held over at the Wilma Theater in its run. The Wilma Theater is a small theater on Sansom Street between 20th and 21st Street. It's housed in an old car factory building and seats about 100 people. The Wilma has been in existence for 3 years, and to open this season, artistic director Yuri Zizka chose the play The Persecution and Assassination of Jean-Paul Marat, as performed by the inmates of the Asylum of